Welcome to Black History Short Stories Podcast. I'm your host, Amandre Johnson. Glad to have you on episode 10. On this podcast, we discuss short stories from Black history with a person that has an invested interest in Black history. Here, we think it is important to carry on the stories of our past and most of all, continue the legacies and memories that are important to our future. Here today, we have Eugene. Please tell us your birth year and where you were born.
Good morning. My name is Eugene. And I was born in the year of November 28th, 1947, here in Roanoke, Virginia.
Outstanding. So, Eugene, you're here today because we're talking about Black people vacations, Black-owned resorts, and Black-owned beaches, and you're one of the more seasoned vacationers that I know. Okay. You, I went on my first cruise, and you taught me everything that I could know about the first cruise, so... When we talked about vacations, it's only fitting that I felt like I talked to you.
Good.
So we're going to start off with Bruce's Beach. Okay. It's in California. It's in Los Angeles County. It's south of Santa Monica.
Okay.
So Willa and Charles Bruce, they moved to Manhattan Beach, and Willa started one of the first Black-owned women businesses there in the city's early days. And that's according to a local historian, Jan Dennis. So in 1912, Charles and Willa bought land between 26th and 27th Street that they would turn into a resort for Black people. They bought it in 1912. In 1915, they started construction, a beachside resort, and they called it Bruce's Beach Lodge.
Okay.
It took them 5 years to start getting built up. And in 1920, they bought another lot next to it, and that had a two-story building. And with that, they added a dance hall and a restaurant. Bruce's Beach was the first place on the Pacific Ocean where Black people could access the beach. And I thought that was an amazing
thing. Yeah.
So they had it in 1920, and from everything that I've read, it thrived. You know, Black people started coming to the beach. They started getting some bigger names at Bruce's Beach. But their success was short-lived. In 1924, the city revoked Bruce's Beach property through eminent domain. And for those who don't know what eminent domain is, it's a legal maneuver allowing the government to take private property for public use. Mm-hmm. So as Black people began to go to the beach, the government said, nah, we're not gonna have that. So they revoked it through an eminent domain and said to turn it to a park. And although at that time when they took it, the resort closed, but Black people still continued to go to the beach because that was the area that they knew at this point. And that was the area that they had deemed safe. And the city tried to combat that by arresting Black people who still would come to the beach. And there are specific occasions in 1927 where Black people are arrested for simply being at the beach.
Okay.
And to further that, they went ahead and tore down the entire resort.
Okay.
So instead of using the eminent domain powers to build a park, like they said, the land stayed vacant for decades, up until the 1950s. And in the 1950s, members of the Bruce family wanted to buy that land back because the city took it from them using eminent domain, but did nothing with it. So in order to combat that, the city said, no, y'all not getting this land back. They finally went ahead and built a park over it. And to further disassociate the Bruces from the beach, they changed the name. They called it Bayview Terrace Park. And that was in 1962 when they named it Bayview Terrace Park. And then in 1974, they changed the name again to Parque Caliacan, and that's Manhattan's beach's sister city in Mexico. And it stayed that way all the way up until 2006, when a man named Mitch Ward, who was the first and only African-American elected into office in Manhattan Beach, he superheaded an initiative to return the park to its original name. He wanted it back to Bruce's Beach. And he said bringing this up was one of the proudest moments, and getting this done was one of the proudest moments on his council. And he got the name in 2006 turned back into Bruce's Beach. And this past year in 2020, they held a Juneteenth rally there.
Okay.
And even today, where Manhattan Beach's black population is less than 1%. People say that there are still instances that make them feel unwanted in the city. And there's an example, when I was doing the research on this, I found an example from 2015. A black family's home was set on fire and the crime was never solved. And many neighbors rallied to their side. The family goes ahead and says that this is a hate crime because there is no other reason to target them other than racial motivation. Also, there was a black man who had lived there for 1 year. And in that 1 year, he got stopped 5 times by the police. Mm-hmm. And he had been stopped 5 times by the police in his entire life. All 5 times in this 1 year at Manhattan Beach. And he decided to move out the city. To this day, there are still people of the Bruce family fighting for reparations for that beach. They want the land back. They want money for the land because shutting them down in, 1924, they lost out on who knows how much money because they were, a thriving resort. The only place that black people could go on the Pacific. So, when black people wanted to go on vacation at the time, this is where they went.
Right. Is that beach located on prime real estate?
I'm unsure.
Okay.
From what I understand, it is because there's a lot of wealthy homes there. And it's, when I looked it up on the map, it's south of Malibu, south of Beverly Hills. So it would be like the outskirts of there. So if you were, I imagine if you wanted to be able to have access to Beverly Hills and have access to Malibu and access to more higher end places and still be outside of the city of LA, this would be one of the places you live.
Okay. That's like prime real estate. Sounds like it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So you say that is near, the beach?
Bruce's Beach?
Yeah. What's near? What's the beach? The beach in California. Where is near?
It's close to Santa Monica.
Yeah, it's Santa Monica. Okay.
It's north of Long Beach.
Okay, so it sounds like that beach in prime. It's in prime neighborhood because I think Santa Monica. That's where Route 66 is the final destination.
Oh. I've learned something today.
Yeah. Route 66 started up in Illinois, near Chicago, and go all the way into Santa Monica Beach.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, of course, at that time, vacations, a lot of blacks had traveled that beach, traveled Route 66.
Interesting.
And right now, I think it's part of Interstate 40.
Okay.
But they have reserved some of the Route 66 for tours.
And see, that's a whole other thing because you are so good at routes and directions. And without GPS, I probably wouldn't make it out of my house.
Well, for me, when I travel, first thing I do, I get me a map.
What?
And I log all my travel through a map because I taught myself how to read a map. And then this is how I found a way, to get around different locations. And also, if I go to a city that I'm not familiar with, I get a city map. And the first thing I do when I go to the hotel, get in my room, I get the city map out, and I study where I'm going. Main thing, if you stay on the main drag, you can go anywhere you want to go. And after 45 minutes, I say, come on, let's go. Time to go. So that's when I know the city.
Oh, see.
But a lot of time I get lost in the city. When I do travel in different cities, I get lost. But that highway going to take you right back where you started from. If you keep driving, you keep going, because you have to, it's not like a maze. You have to figure your way out how to get back to the main drag.
If I know that if I went to travel, and let's say my phone went dead or my GPS stopped working.
Okay.
Wherever I'm at, I probably live there now, because okay. I'll never find my way out.
Well, you know, that's why I enjoy going to New York, because I want to go back to New York and learn the street. Now, Washington, D.C. is very tricky if you go, if you drive me through Washington, D.C. And the easiest place that I have really, where I have driven at is California. Mm. It's so easy. But you got the freeway.
Indeed. Indeed.
But you got to know how to take the, you got to know how to make that exit. Sometimes, someplace you go to a town, you only see the exit one time. If you miss it, you got to drive several miles, you know, you go to find another one. But so, California is about the best place I have driven so far to find my way around.
I have to make that trip there. But what this research led me to do is it led me to wonder, because even still today, they're still fighting for Bruce's Beaches, and that's going to be a continuing story. And that story's not finished. That history's not done yet, because they're still fighting for rights. But it led me to wonder, you know, today when we think about vacationing, we talk about places like you talk about, just hitting the road, hitting California, hitting Florida, what was that history like for Black people? So I found a list of Black-owned beaches and resorts that Black people would go to, you know, early on. And I found the history of that. And a big shout out to Angela Dennis, who wrote up this article that mentioned all these beaches. So what we're going to do is we're going to go through some of these beaches, and, you know, maybe you've been to some of these places, maybe you haven't, but we'll talk about the short history of all these beaches and resorts. So the first one we're going to talk about is Highland Beach in Maryland. You ever been there?
No, ma'am. No. The only beaches where I've been in Maryland were Ocean City. Okay. And of course, Ocean City.
All right. Well, this is the oldest of all Black resort towns in America.
What's the name of it again?
Highland Beach.
Highland.
Mm-hmm. It was founded by Charles and Laura Douglas in 1893. And Charles was the son of Frederick Douglass. This place is 35 miles outside of Washington, D.C., and was the very first Black-owned resort in the history of America. Today, there are still approximately 90 homes still owned and occupied by descendants of the original settlers of Highland Beach. And there's a Frederick Douglass Museum and Cultural Center called Twin Oaks is like a big attraction there. And as this got more popular, you'll see big names go there, like Langston Hughes stayed there, W.E.B. Du Bois, Powell Robinson, and they all had a summer home at Highland Beach.
Okay, you said Highland Beach, Highland Park Beach? Highland.
Highland Beach.
Okay, I got you. It's in what part of Maryland?
It didn't say. It just said 35 miles outside of D.C.
Okay.
I didn't look that one up on the map. We could do that.
Okay. All right.
And one of my goals now was to visit all these beaches.
Okay.
There's also American Beach, and this one is in Jacksonville, Florida.
All right.
It's on Amelia Island. It was founded in 1935. American Beach is Florida's first African-American beach. It was founded by Florida's first Black millionaire, Abraham Lincoln Lewis. And he owned a African-American life insurance company. Lewis bought this up as a safe haven that his friends and employees could peacefully enjoy themselves. The streets along the beach are all named after their African-American founders and families. It was once known as the Negro Ocean Playground. It began to have a bunch of food, lodging, and tons of entertainment. It's quoted saying it was a place for refuge for Black people during a time when other beaches were out of their reach due to segregation. And you'll see a lot of these names come up as, you know, Black vacations go. You'll see a lot of the same people start showing, but this beach was often, it says on any given weekend, you could have often visitors like Ray Charles, Zora Neale Hurston, or Hank Aaron. And they're just out there having a good time.
Okay, that is in Florida?
Yep, Jacksonville, Florida.
Jacksonville, all right. Oh, okay, many times I've been through there, never realized.
Oh, the history is everywhere.
Yeah, you're right. Exactly right. But like I said, we're not aware of it until you research it.
You're right. Another one, and this one I'm sure you heard of, and this area is tricky because I've read so much about this area. Oak Bluffs or Martha Vineyard in Massachusetts.
Heard of it.
Yes, this is one of President Obama's and, you know, the late Maya Angelou's, one of their favorite vacation destinations.
And also the Kennedys, too.
Oh, yeah, I was going to say, Martha Vineyard has a long history of celebrities and very powerful people staying there. During the era of segregation, Martha's Vineyard was a popular beachfront for white tourists, and thanks to Charles Shearer, the son of an enslaved person and her white owner, he turned a beach cottage into the first inn where African-Americans could lodge in 1912. So this began the expansion of the Black community on Martha's Vineyard. Today, there's an African-American Heritage Trail where you can get a chance to view historic homes of Black people in the history and the history of it.
Yeah, we took a cruise up there 2 years ago, and we stopped in Massachusetts, in Boston. And we didn't get a chance to visit the Martha Vineyard.
Didn't. I also understand that I think it's Martha's Vineyard up there, to where like Native American is part of that, wherever they lived at, that area is part Native American land too. It's reservation.
Okay.
And it's like drastically different, like two different worlds that are, you know, that border each other, but I'd have to do more research on that.
Yeah.
The next one is Sag Harbor, Long Island, New York. So have you heard of the Hamptons?
Yeah.
Well, Sag Harbor is the Black wing of the Hamptons. Beginning in the early 20th century, it was an enclave for generations. So after World War II, during segregation, Sag Harbor developed a really large Black community, and it was a lot of working class Black families that were able to purchase land and start a development in the area. So, and it's still up today because over the years, Sag Harbor has been able to defeat gentrification and property development and keep its roots intact. It's remained important to Black residents. Even still today, you can visit and still see a huge community of middle-class families and their big population of, you know, Black doctors, lawyers, and other working-class professionals here.
But, you know, that Hampton Beach, that's a prime real estate out there today. A lot of rich people, they have their homes up there.
Places I'll visit but never own any land.
Yeah, right. I heard of Hampton Beach, a very, 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 very prime real estate up there. Very expensive, too.
I believe it. One you're probably familiar with, Atlantic Beach. And what you say?
In South Carolina? What, Atlantic Beach? Atlantic Beach?
Yes, sir. In South Atlantic? Carolina.
South Carolina. Yeah, I heard of it. Yeah. In fact, we went to it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's right up north from Myrtle Beach.
Yep. It's in North Myrtle Beach. It was once known as the Black Pearl. Mm-hmm. It was established in 1934. It's located right between Myrtle Beach and the city of North Myrtle Beach.
Exactly, right on 17.
Today, it remains the only Black-owned beach in the United States.
Right, exactly.
Many properties and businesses there are still Black-owned, including hotels, gift shops, restaurants, and nightclubs. And every year, people from across the nation run to Myrtle Beach for Memorial Day weekend.
Yeah, they shoot up
to celebrate Bike Week.
Right, they do. Right.
If you've never seen Bike Week, it is an experience. I went for the first time last year and was
I never been to one. I heard about it.
It's amazing. There's when I say tens of thousands of people, there are bikes from all across the nation.
Yeah. And also what I heard too, that most of the majority of the business closed down because they didn't want them there.
So I live in South Carolina now. I asked a bunch of, you know, I asked people, you know, why, because there's two bike weeks and there's referred to as Black Bike Week and there's referred to White Bike Week.
For the holidays, right?
So White Bike Week is in Murrells Inlet.
Exactly.
And it stretches to Myrtle Beach.
Yeah.
And that's usually the week before Memorial Day weekend. And then there's Black Bike Week, which is four, like 30 minutes north. So completely separate.
Right.
And I learned that, you know, Atlantic Beach is a black owned beach, which is why Black Bike Week is focused there.
Right. Right.
So there's also the Gullah Geechee Islands, and that's also in South Carolina. And this place is, if you've never been here, it's beautiful. It's in the low country. Talks about the Gullah Geechee traditions that have lasted throughout the years.
How far from Paulet Island?
How far is Gullah Geechee Beach?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
That's going to probably be an hour and a half, because that's going to be, I believe, to be the southern part of Charleston and continuing down to like Beaufort area.
Okay, I got you. Okay.
And what these people are is they are direct descendants of Central and West Africa that were enslaved on these islands that were very isolated. So they got to maintain their culture so much. And to this day, they still do that. If you go down here and you talk to these people, you would think that they were from a different place. You would not think that they are from the U.S. because of their accent and their dialect is super strong. It talks about them developed a Creole language. And it is strong today. A lot of my good friends from the Charleston area, from like places like Hugie, St. Helena Island, they all speak with these deep Gullah accents. It's very distinct. Today, they still practice the arts, crafts, agriculture, and the edible cuisine, which is why in South Carolina, if you've ever had a home-cooked meal in South Carolina, rice
is
a staple.
Wow. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Wow. Gotta have rice.
Yeah.
And that's a tradition that's been held on from, you know, West Africa.
Right. Most of the rice are grown from the wild.
Mm-hmm. Today, there's still the Gullah Heritage Trail Tour that's on Hilton Head Island. Mm-hmm. You could drive through compounds and stop at several historic sites. There's the Mitchfield, the first freedman village in the U.S. Mm-hmm. There's the Gullah Geechee Visitor Center in Beaufort. There's the Penn Center on St. Helena Island, which I've been there. The Penn Center is frozen in time.
Okay.
And from different time periods. There are still buildings there that they preserved from the 1800s. There's a cottage there that was built for Martin Luther King. There's houses there. There's a school there for Freedom Schools. It's a place that is, you know, frozen in time. It's a great place to go with a
time. Is that the main drag? Is it off of Highway 17 going southbound?
Honestly, you know? Don't know if that is off Highway 17. Honestly don't know.
Okay.
I believe so, but I'm not 100% sure.
Yeah, because I know so when I travel Highway 17 and go through these small towns, which they have a lot of history.
Uh-huh.
As you motor down through from South Carolina on down into Florida.
Okay.
But Highway 17 is a seacoast highway.
Mm.
Yeah, it's Highway 17 is a coastal highway.
So it goes all the way up the entire coast?
All the way into Florida. It goes, I'm trying to think, I think it started up in the northern part of Maryland. I might be wrong.
Wow.
Somewhere, I know it goes through, down Tidewater area.
Mm-hmm.
Not part of Hampton, you know, in that way. I think it's somewhere up in northern part of Maryland or somewhere in northern part of Pennsylvania. I might be wrong. I'm trying to pinpoint. But it's a coastal highway go from north to south. I'll put that away. All the way to Florida.
Wow. Wow. Well, 17 will get you started taking this. And then I guess you get on 95 to go to what they call Chicken Bone Beach in Atlantic City, New Jersey.
Oh, yeah. Been there. My uncle lived there. Been there. Spent a lot of time up there.
Oh, at Chicken Bone Beach?
No, not beach, but Atlantic City.
Oh, Atlantic City.
Yeah, I never heard of the beach. The only beach I've been to of Atlantic City was the Atlantic Beach. Atlantic
well, City. Tell you why. It was designated as the exclusive African-American section of the beach around 1900.
Okay.
And it remained a Black-only beach until 1964 Civil Rights Act was passed. So in 1964, a lot of these Black beaches that we're talking about now, once the Civil Rights Act was passed, they were no longer designated as only Black beaches. So a lot of, you know, the tourism that was specific to Black people died down because they could go to beaches closer to where they lived at then.
Right.
It was more of a, you know, not necessarily denying, saying, I don't want to go to the Black beach. It makes more sense for me to go to this beach that's closer.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But During the segregation era before 1900, blacks and whites in Atlantic City, they lived side by side and they used the beach without, you know, restriction. It was no issue. There was no problem.
Oh, I know.
But after 1900, as people from the South came north to Atlantic City to mm-hmm. start vacationing and they started spending time there, they made complaints and white people restricted the beach or segregated the beach to say, to appease Southerners coming up, because in the Southern way of life, it was, everything was segregated.
Right.
So when they came to vacation or north, they expected that same process. And that's just during the Jim Crow time, that's what they were accustomed to. So by the 1940s, black entrepreneurs began to provide entertainment, you know, during the summer evenings at Chickabone Beach. And it included people like Sammy Davis Jr., Louis Jordan, the Mills brother, Jackie Moms Mabley, and the Club Harlem Showgirls. Mm-hmm. And they would, you know, run shows and they would be on tour there. The showgirls also, the subgirls dubbed the beach Sunshine Row. And they soon began attracting other visitors by, you know, alternately sunbathing and putting on brief skits and performing. Visits came by Sugar Ray Robinson, Peggy Thomas, and this, as the big names started coming, the beach started growing, like appeal wanted to grow through it. I mean, appeal grew and people wanted to go there. When I was looking this up, I wondered why they called it Chicken Bone Beach.
Well, and you can imagine.
So I found it. We found it. They called it Chicken Bone Beach because the vacation and families there mm-hmm. had a tradition of, you know, bringing umbrellas, blankets, beach balls, and they had picnics.
Right.
And when they had picnics, they had fried chicken or chicken.
That's right. There you go.
And when they finished eating the chicken, they buried the bones in the sand. You knew this? You've done that before?
No. I know where you're going when you say chicken. Because when we go up to New Jersey, see my uncle lived in Atlantic City, mm-hmm. and my mom used to, we never did stop nowhere, you know, because, you know, to get nothing to eat because it was nothing open for us.
Ah.
But the thing was, mom always fried chicken and boiled eggs.
Ah, interesting. Yeah, I know. And when I read this, I look back, you know, when we went on vacation, you know, chicken was just one of the things that we bought. You know,
that's
just,
true. Right. Right.
What you
that's bought. True. So, and I mean, I still do it today. When I go on vacation, I fry some chicken and boil some eggs. And when we get to our rest stop, for example, if we're going on Florida on vacation, we always stop at the first rest stop on 95 and before you cross the river interstate rest stop in Florida, we always get a picnic table. That's where we spread out.
Wow, that's outstanding.
But now my son, he's doing it now. So, you know, that was actually that's what we did. You know, that's what we did back in the days.
Wow. When they and the Atlantic City Council passed an ordinance in 1997 declaring Chicken Bone Beach a historical landmark. Today, mm-hmm. it will be known as Missouri Avenue Beach.
Oh, okay.
So if you ever get there again, you'll probably want to look up Missouri Avenue Beach. But I'm sure if you ask some people about Chicken Bone Beach, that's from there. I'm sure they'll be able to outrage you guys.
Yeah, because I never did. My uncle, he lived all his life, but I don't think he never did mention anything about it, about Chicken Bone Beach.
Wow. Huh. Interesting.
At that time, you know, because the only place that I knew, I'd been up there, is going to Atlantic Beach. Huh. And in fact, where he lived, I can't think of the street, but his business was on the corner of Kentucky and Baltic Avenue. And I used to walk about four blocks, I'd be at the beach.
Oh, that's, nice.
That's where his business, because he had the service station business up there on the corner of Kentucky and Baltic Avenue. And I stayed up there for approximately 2 weeks during the time I was on vacation, all by myself before I got married.
I'm sure that was fun.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, I enjoyed it, you know, going up there. And when you go to the Atlantic City Beach, they had the amusement park called the Steel Pier. Oh. All entertainments on that pier. All the rides and everything up there. You know, that was a booming place, Lank City was. The boardwalk.
Huh. I'm looking at the map now.
Mm-hmm.
And Chicken Bone Beach is right there on Atlantic Avenue. It's south of the Steel Pier that you're talking about.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay.
It's what is right on the Atlantic City Boardwalk was today, like right one street over from Bally's Atlantic City Hotel and Casino.
Oh, okay. So, I was there, but I didn't realize it.
You know what's weird? On Google, it tells you like it was a formerly racially segregated beach.
Oh, okay. Well, I think at that time when I went up there, this back in the '60s, you know, I would never have known that, you know, that the beach was never exist because everybody was with it all in one place.
Right. The next one, we're going to go a little bit further north. Idlewild Resort in Michigan. So it started off as white land developers marketed Idlewild as an all-Negro resort town. It's in mm-hmm. Lake County, Michigan, 300 miles northwest of Chicago and 250 miles north of Detroit. And it's through the Idlewild Resort Company. It was founded okay. in 1912. The resort property sales lagged until Dr. Daniel Hale Williams, at the time the leading Black surgeon in America, bought property there in 1915. So when he bought property there, his presence attracted other colleagues and associates from Washington, and eventually other prominent Black doctors in the Midwest began purchasing property there, including Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois, author Charles Waldo Chestnut, millionaire businesswoman, Madam C.J. Walker, mm-hmm. and Chicago attorney Violet Neely Anderson. They all purchased properties there. 1950s and early 1960s, Idlewild reached the height of its popularity. During that time, nearly 25,000 vacationers made their way to the community.
Now, when you say beach, well, that's on Lake Michigan Lake? Was that on the lake?
This is a resort.
So, I mean, what body? Was the Lake Michigan?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Okay.
When I looked up the pictures of it, yes, it was on the lake.
Okay, all right.
And vacationers who went there, you know, some stayed there, made their stay permanent, you know, and added to the year-round population. During this era, Idlewild had more than 300 Black-owned businesses. What Idlewild signified was Black economic empowerment and entertainment glamour. Like all other Black resorts during this time, it did not survive the civil rights movement. So were places that were formerly white only clubs and resorts across the nation integrated in 1964, it began to decline. And again, I believe that's because people just said, this is closer. Or this okay. is more convenient at that time. So its clubs and hotels began to close as, you know, Black people went to other resorts. And today, Idlewild still stands, but it is a retirement community with fewer than a half dozen businesses. And, you know, despite this decline, Idlewood symbolized the heyday of the combination of race, leisure, and geography to create a prosperous Black community, and this is the place I still want to visit there, you know, even if it's just still an old retirement community, I still want to visit there.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like I said, my goal is to visit all these places. The next one, we're going back to Cali. Named the Inkwell, and this is in Santa Monica, California. And you can figure out why they call it the Inkwell.
Oh, I understand, yeah.
Yeah, but it was in reference to the skin color of beachgoers, as this article puts it.
Right.
nonetheless, African Americans in Southern California, like, you know, everywhere else, transformed that hateful word into, you know, a badge of pride. You know, they wore that. The inkwell is what it was. It's where we like to go. That's where we're going to go. Whatever. Mm-hmm. It was originally located at the western end of Pico Boulevard and stretched two city blocks to Bicknell Street. It was situated near Philip Chapel Christian Methodist Episcopal Church. It was the first black church in Santa Monica, which also anchored in early black settlement around 4th and Bay Streets in the city. I think it's important to name the cities. You know, I've never been here before, but, you know, if somebody's listening who has, and or if you wanted to look it up and do further, you can see how big this area was. That's why, you know, we named the streets to see how far, you know, we're going and how far this outreach goes. So at this beach, black people could socialize and enjoy the ocean and with not none, but less racial harassment than other beaches in the area. In 1922, the Santa Monica Bay Protected League attempted to purge black people from the city's shoreline by blocking the effort by the Ocean Frontage Syndicate, a black investment group led by Norman Houston and Charles Darden, to develop a resort with the beach access at the base of Pico Boulevard. So these two guys wanted to come in, and they owned an investment group, and they wanted to invest in a black resort. And the city was like, nah, we not having that. But local black civil rights leaders, they reflected the ambivalence of the general black population on the continued existence of Inkwell. And, you know, and while they appreciated access to the Pacific Ocean that the beach represented, they also wanted an end to all efforts to inhibit their freedom to use all public beaches. You know, thank you for, I mean, I won't say, I guess they said, they appreciated the fact that they could have access to the beach, but they wanted all access to the beach.
Right.
You know, we earned the right to, we deserve the right to be able to go to any beach. On February 7th, 2008, the Santa Monica, City of Santa Monica officially recognized the Inkwell and Nick Gabaldon, the first documented black surfer, with a landmark at Bay Street and the Oceanfront Walk.
Okay.
And Nick Gabaldon, that'll be a whole nother story on its own. Be the first black surfer. I've seen people surf. It don't look fun to me. Not my thing. One more. I'm sure if you've never been here, you've passed through it. Freeman Beach in Wilmington, North Carolina, also called Sea Breeze Resort.
Mm-hmm.
It was one of two beaches available to African Americans in the state during Jim Crow era. The beach area, originally 99 acres, it was undeveloped beachfront near Myrtle Grove Sound. It was acquired by former enslaved people, Alexander and Charity Freeman. So former slaves bought the land up. The legend has it that the beachfront resort community name came from fishermen who found the winds flowing off the Atlantic a refreshing respite of the hot sun. Freeman purchased the beach acreage in 1855. Over the years, the couple enlarged their holdings to include 180 acres. By the time that Alexander died in 1872, by 1876, Alexander's descendants, because that land got passed down to his children and so on, Robert Bruce Freeman Sr. bought an additional 2,500 acres at $1 an acre.
Wow.
Yeah. When he died, Robert Bruce Freeman Jr., it says, at his death, Robert Bruce Freeman Jr. parceled the land in tracts designed to be self-supporting waterfront properties to a number of relatives. So he ended up giving the land to, you know, members of his family. The beach community became a home to a number of black families, including generations of Freedmans, Wades, Rossers, Davises, McQuillans, and McNeils. Two of Robert Bruce Freeman's heirs, Roland Freeman and Nathan Freeman, played a major role in developing Sea Breeze as a resort in the 1920s. Between the 20s and the 60s, Freeman Beach, also known as Sea Breeze Resort, developed rich cultural traditions as history as blacks from across Eastern and Central North Carolina traveled for miles to experience the wooden dance floors, the jukebox. They found a place to vacation, to relax, to play. From the 20s through the 60s, the beach had three hotels, 10 restaurants, dozens of rental cottages, a boat pier, a bingo parlor, a small amusement park, and a Ferris wheel. So this is a big deal. Okay. During the summer months, thousands of visitors went to the area. But this didn't even make it to civil rights. And this goes with this happened to a couple beaches during this time. In 1954, Hurricane Hazel came and it really, really messed it up. It really tore down everything. And when I did this research, I found a couple beaches that were destroyed by Hurricane Hazel. Because that caused more beach erosion, which increased after an opening of the artificial Carolina Beach Inlet in 1952. And by the late 1960s, when desegregation opened other beaches to African Americans, you know, Freeman Beach lost a lot of its summer visitors.
Right.
Many of the older landmarks were blown down or washed away by, if not Hurricane Hazel, other hurricanes in the 90s. And it's just, ever since 1954, it's just been on this real bad decline. Our next beach, we're going to travel back up to Maryland. And this is Carrs, also known as Sparrow Beach in Annapolis, Maryland. Carrs Beach and it neighbors Sparrow Beach. So like when I researched this, they put a slash to it, Carrs/Sparrow Beach. Were two major Chesapeake Bay resorts that catered exclusively to Black people between 1930s and 1960s. It was owned by sisters Elizabeth Carr Smith and Florence Carr Sparrow. The beaches were a vacation retreat for Black families in the Mid-Atlantic region. The origins of Carr's Beach can be traced back to 1902. When Frederick and Mary Wells Carr purchased 180 acres of farmland on the Annapolis Neck Peninsula. While the family farmed the land as early as 1909, the Carr family hosted picnics and church outings and took in boarders. In 1926, 2 years before Frederick Carr's death, the family founded Carr's Beach. Florence Carr Sparrow, one of the daughters who inherited the family's lands, created Sparrow Beach in 1931. It was just north of Carrs Beach, and the two resorts operated side by side, but as separate businesses. And they attracted thousands of visitors from Philly, Pennsylvania, from Philly, New York, Maryland, Wilmington, Pittsburgh, D.C., and they frequented the beach, and they went swimming and had picnics, and had other family community-centered events. By 3 o'clock, however, many visitors made their way to Carrs Beach Pavilion to see and dance to the latest hit songs. It was people there who locally, or they brought in popular entertainers. Some of those that they brought in was Billie Holiday, Duke Ellington, Count Basie, or Count Basie. I wasn't sure. You're on mute.
Count Basie.
Count Basie, okay. Yeah. Ella Fitzgerald, Dina Washington, Lionel Hampton, Ray Charles, James Brown, and Jackie Wilson. Rock and roll performers Fats Domino and Buddy Holly. You know them?
Oh, yeah. Those guys came to Dumas in Roanoke.
Oh, wow. So they frequented, like, the tours seem like they go to all the Black spots across the East Coast and across the nation, really. On July 21st, 1956, there was estimated 70,000 people traveled to Carrs Beach to hear the one and only Chuck Berry perform.
Yep.
And 8,000 people were only able to get in because it was at capacity of 8,000. Now they said 70,000 people came.
Well, you know why, don't you? Everybody wants to see Chuck Berry?
Why?
You know why? Because he does that famous duck walk.
The duck walk? Yeah. I'm going to have to look this up. I'm not familiar with the duck walk. So also, in addition to him, in the early 60s, you know, people, Little Richard would come, Lloyd Price, Etta James, Aretha Franklin.
Oh, yeah.
Shirelles, and the Coasters and the Drifters.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm familiar with some of those people, but not
all
those.
All right.
they came. So this was a huge resort. And one of the ones I thought was worth mentioning was, it's called Mackenzie Beach. And that's in Pawleys Island, South Carolina. Now, is a well-known vacation resort. It was owned by Frank and Lizzie Mackenzie, and it was visited by some of the same Black artists who would visit Carr's Beach, you know, Count Basie, Duke Ellington, Ella Fitzgerald, yep. Little Richard. This is one of those beaches I was talking about that was also destroyed in 1954 by Hurricane Hazel. And it is now owned by the by what's called the Litchfield Company. So if you go through Pawleys Island, a good part of the beach is owned by the Litchfield Company, and to the point to where there's a north and south of Litchfield Beach. So Okay. They own so much area. And to this day, if you drive past and you Google Mackenzie Beach and you try to go there, it'll pull you into, you could pull into a gate and you could see a road path and you could just see the abandoned buildings. There's a strip of abandoned buildings, look like it could have been cottages. From what I read, there was probably camp spots for kids, for clubs. Okay. To talk about how in the early years before, in the early 50s, you would often see, you know, kids walking down Highway 17 with camp counselors doing like their camp activities coming from Mackenzie Beach. And that included a lot of Black people. So I think that was worthy to note. And there are others on here that we could talk about, but those are some of the bigger ones that we wanted to address. And to say that, you know, although it seems like there's a lot of places for Black people to vacation, you know, this was a limited thing.
Right.
To have a safe vacation. But Black people made it work.
Yeah, I think it's more the Blacks, they were more comfortable going north.
Oh yeah.
They had where they felt free.
Right.
And of course, that's where I spend most of my time up north, because I had family there. Mm-hmm. And I felt, you know, very free. I didn't come across any type of discrimination at all up there.
Outstanding. So what we're going to do is we're going to take a quick break, hear from our sponsors, and then we'll come back to our favorite part of the podcast, the questions.
Okay.
Welcome back. And, you know, before we get into our questions, I want to give a quick shout out to the Perlow Podcast Network, Dr. Tom the Colonel, who recently talked about Pat Mahomes and his $500 million contract. And also to the Perlow Podcast Top 10 list. This week's list is top 10 game shows ever. And Eugene, we talked about it during your break. What would be your number one game show would be?
I would say Family Feud with Steve Harvey. I mean, I'm not too much on game shows.
Okay.
I pick Steve Harvey, Family Feud.
I don't blame you. So we'll see if we'll have to listen in to see if yours makes the top 10. If they agree with you and yours is number one.
Okay.
I also want to give a shout out to podcast Black Educators Matter, and Danielle Moneyham runs that podcast, and her goal is to interview 500 Black educators and discuss the education regarding our Black students today. And I think that's a great podcast. Please give that a listen, and that's streaming on Apple Music and wherever else you stream your podcast. Okay, so into these questions. Do you consider historical relevance when going on vacation?
Do you say, consider historical relevance?
Yes, when you're going on vacations.
Yeah, I do. I always do. Yeah. When I go on vacation, I try to find a historical place to visit.
What do you look for specifically, like Black history, or do you just look for something that you want to learn new?
No, Black history.
Okay.
Because everywhere I go, I try to, like, for example, when I go see my son live in Maryland, and we go to the Black Wax Museum.
Mm.
And in fact, he don't live too far from it, and we spend a great amount of time there.
How is it? Is that big? I've heard about it, but I've never been there.
Yeah, it's pretty very educational, and then I think they got two or three floors.
Oh wow!
Yeah, it's a wax museum. It's very educational.
Okay.
And when I do travel, that's what I like to do. I get some brochures and just go to my favorite room and go through them, and that's, then find out where it's located. You know how far I have to drive, and that's why I go visit.
Yeah, I do the same thing. I do. I often will find myself, you know, driving in a new area while I'm on vacation and seeing a name that I'm not familiar with, and I'll Google that name. I got to find out who that person is. I got to find out what they did. Why are they memorialized?
Exactly.
Charleston is, I can remember one of my first instances, you know, years ago when I first visited Charleston, and we went down to the farmer's market, and it looked strange to me. And I was with my friend, he was from Charleston. And I said, what's up with this farmer's market? And he was like, I don't know. And then, you know, you look to the right and left and there's a church that we went to, was church that turned into a nightclub. Okay. And it's advertised like on the building, it says Charles Pinckney Church. And, you know, immediately, you know, I'm sitting outside this club. He's trying to wait to get in, trying to figure out what's going in. I'm trying to Google about Charles Pinckney and everything that he did. And why people are clubbing in his old church. But going back to that farmer's market, what I found out was, when I researched that, is that used to be slave trading or slave buying center in Charleston. Yeah. They still have like a block that, you know, they used to put enslaved people on to sell. And I thought that was super interesting because
when you took your cruise out of Charleston, that's right, not too far from the cruise ship.
Right. Yep. You're right.
Yeah. Cause we stopped. Yeah. We was there and we visited there. And also while I was in, South Carolina coming back from Florida, we stopped in a place called Teterboro.
I'm not
sure. Teterboro was one, was an airport there. Teterboro. It was one of the home of the, Black Airmen, Tuskegee Black Airmen.
I did not.
And that's where I trained at.
What?
Yes, Ralph 95.
Wow.
Yeah, we stopped there and we spend right amount of time there. They got a nice memorial site where they have, you know, a lot of people was there doing training.
Well,
and it was very educational.
Normally
when I travel up in 95, if I see anything historical, I got to pull over and research.
Indeed.
Sometimes when I do go to Florida, and it took me 3 days to get back to Virginia.
Wow.
Because I'm stopping everywhere.
I'm not mad at you. Charleston also has a Black History Museum, and I have not yet been able to get there.
Okay.
I found out about it like right before, you know, quarantine and shutdowns happened.
Right, I know. Right.
So yeah. I have not been able to get there yet, but I'm going to go. Can you tell about your favorite childhood or adult vacation and why?
Well, my childhood, like I said before, I had relatives live in New Jersey and New York and Ohio. I think my favorite childhood I enjoyed going to visit my uncle in Ohio. He used to live in Cleveland, Ohio. And he took us to a golf driving range. It's the first time I ever have a golf club in my hand and went to a driving range there.
Oh,
and of course, he was a golf player. And it's the only place that we couldn't go, you know, right in the city area where I'm from. But that's one of my favorite. My favorite childhood is when my parents was taking us to see our relatives. Yeah. Like I said, New York was a favorite place. Bronx, New York. My uncle lived there, and of course, you know, I sit there, never sleep, and enjoy there. Yeah. And then had an uncle live in Atlantic City, and go visit him. And so that's probably my favorite for my parents. When parents took us on, you know, see our uncles.
Okay, aunts. That's always nice. We didn't really travel out of state a lot. Vacation when I was young, we went to Virginia Beach.
Mm-hmm.
My sisters got to go to Florida. I didn't get to go, and I can't remember why I didn't get to go.
Okay.
But they got to go to Florida and have fun. But that's we're big, and you know, all my sisters and I now, we're pretty big on traveling to try to make sure we get to see places and things that, you know, we didn't always get to see. Growing up, were there places you did not feel comfortable going or felt you weren't welcome?
No. No, because like I said before, we never did went down deep south, and all my traveling was up north, northeast part of the states.
Okay.
And I felt, well, we felt, you know, very comfortable and didn't have no issues nowhere.
Oh, that's good. That is amazing. I could say the same. I can't think of a time when vacationing that I felt uncomfortable in a place or that I didn't feel welcome. I feel like if I look at a place and say, you know, I don't think I'm welcome there. I won't go there. There are still places I see today. There's a place.
Same here. Mostly your mom and pop places, hole in the wall.
Yeah.
And I don't feel, you know, if you see a place we got two or three cars there, I say no, I'm keep driving. Yeah.
There's a bar that is around the corner from where I live now, and it's a pretty popular place. And it's very extremely popular during, you know, White People's Bike Week. And for instance, tonight, and on the board of the place, they have a Confederate flag. That's on the sign at the place. So immediately I say, you know, I won't be attending this spot.
Right.
But they often have black musicians come there. Like tonight, Bone Thugs and Harmony is going to be there performing.
Well, speaking of that, we was in Myrtle Beach. And there's a place north Myrtle Beach, I think by north part of Atlantic Beach, place called Tar Babies.
That's what?
Yeah, Tar Baby. And of course,
how long ago was this?
Oh, this was back in the 80s. No, not well. I would say late 80s, early 90s. There's a big restaurant up there on 17. If you pass Atlantic Beach, it's on the left side called Tar Babies.
Of course,
we didn't stop there.
No, absolutely not. There's still, you know, I see fireworks shops in places that have Confederate flags. You know, I don't do fireworks for the most part anyway.
Yeah.
But no, that's just blatant. That's just, they might as well have a sign that says whites only.
Well, I mean, that's why I look at it. Might as well, you know. It's right. It's right north on 17. Right north of. I don't know if it's still there or not. I did see that building there, a restaurant there. The restaurant there is called Tar Babies.
Wow, that is disturbing.
And there's one place that we went to in South Carolina. We stopped this one shopping. As you go in, what's the name of that place? It's a marketplace. Used to be a popular marketplace. I can't think of the name of it, but we stopped there and did a little shopping. And I don't like, I see some artwork. Artist had drew a picture of a kid eating the watermelon. And that's kind of get me a little bit disturbed when I see that. You know, got big lips and eating the watermelon. And that's why I said I would never go back there.
Yeah, you know, that makes me think. I had a job a couple years ago, and it was doing beach resorts here in South Carolina. And I did, like, maintenance, little things. I go in, change light bulbs, clean up a little bit, move furniture, you know, little things for people who come on vacation who they don't want to do that. And there's this particular beach house, and it's owned by, you know, well, I didn't know who it was owned by first. So the first time I go in there, I look around, and there's all these like Sambo dolls, and there's dolls with black women picking cotton. There's pictures of black people on, you know, farms and whatnot, and it's throughout the entire house. And, you know, there's a lot of black art, black people depicted in the art there, you know, Some of them are doing nothing but standing. Some of them are standing in the field. And I look around and I say, who in the world owns this house? Who decorated this house? So I go back to the company. I look up who owns the house, and it's an older white woman. And, you know, I start asking, I started telling people about this story, and someone who's from, who's lived in South Carolina a long time, who's a realtor, says, yeah, that was pretty common in the 90s. He said that was a big craze for homes in the 90s for homes to be decorated like that, specifically for like showrooms, if you were showing a house. Right, and that makes, I mean, it made more sense to me then, being that this is a vacation rental that had all this stuff in it. And I felt uncomfortable in that house because, you know, seeing that stuff, it was kind of disturbing. I don't know what your message is with all these things.
Yeah, why you have it there? You know what?
Right.
What do you get out of it?
I know that I said this to myself when I was there. I said if I had booked this home as a rental, like just going by, you know, the amount of rooms, the proximity to entertainment, and the stuff I want to do, if I booked this room and I showed up, I mean, I booked this house and I showed up and all that decoration was in there, I'd have a fit. Yeah. I would go off.
Yeah.
I would be so upset. So upset.
Yeah, for me, when I see places like that, like if I go to a drive-by yard sale or flea market, if I see one flag, rubber flag, I'm not going to stop there.
Oh, absolutely not.
Because that is my money. I work hard for, so why I gonna give it to you where you can buy some more flags?
You're so right.
Although flag is to me, it's not about a cloth. You know, I usually wax my car, clean my floors. You know, but still, it's the principle of it. It's the background.
I agree, and you know. Bringing that up, we'll get off the topic here a little bit. But, you know, Confederate flags are coming down everywhere. You know, people are getting upset. I have never once known a loser to get to, you know, still promote themselves. Losers don't deserve statues, trophies, or flags. That's true. You lost. I don't understand that. You got to take your L and you got to go.
Right.
So.
And then I don't think a lot of people don't know the history behind that flag. I don't know nothing about that flag. On the flag I know but on two flags I know, it's the state flag and the flag of USA. It's the only flag I know.
Yeah, right.
You know. I mean, in a way, you know, they're always on display.
Right.
But yeah. I'm quite sure that during the time of history, the flag that we had a lot of slaves fought in the Civil War.
Oh yeah.
But they didn't honor their flag.
Regarding Black history, what do you consider to be the most significant event in your life?
I would think going to an all-Black school.
Tell me about that.
When you go to an all-Black school, it was we had learned a lot about our own history.
Now, are you talking about high school? Are you talking about college?
Oh, I'm talking about starting from the elementary.
Okay.
You know, back in my days.
Uh-huh.
When I was coming up. And we had teachers had a lot of respect for us. And it was like a family.
Okay.
But we were when I go into all Black school, we didn't have no issue about anything because we learned a lot. Uh-huh.
And you had all Black teachers?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
This
is back in the 60s.
So did you, let's see, you said you were born in 47.
Yeah, I was born in 47, yeah. And of course, you know, by me
So you would have graduated in a segregated school. Did you you graduated from a segregated school?
Segregated schools, which I stayed at 1 year and was very, very, very uncomfortable.
So wait, so you integrated 1 year, which your senior year?
Carver school I attended closed down in 66. That's when integration started.
Okay.
Back in 66.
So how many years did you spend in an integrated school?
I spent that 1 year. And it was very uncomfortable.
What made it uncomfortable, would you say?
When you go to a lunchroom and you sit down at the table and they get up and move.
Wow.
And when you, school bus picked us up, where we at? We rode in the back seat. Now, by experience that, when you sat in the back seat, that was a good thing for us. Because I tell you why. We can keep an eye on them up front. See, if we sit in the front, you never know what's going to become flying back of your head.
Right. Right.
You see what I'm saying?
Interesting. So would you say that, so comparison to your first 3 years of high school, or, you know, your years of middle school, speaking about, you know, you said you learned your history, speaking of African and African-American education, your senior year, did you find that you furthered your education on that, or it was disregarded?
My senior year, going into a white school, we didn't have that. We didn't have, and they don't teach you anything about history, black history in the white school at all, which we did, of course, we already knew a lot. On the white school, on the history that they do rely on is Booker T. Washington and George Washington. You know, Frederick Douglass, and that's as far as they went. And the only thing they taught us is about Civil War, war between states. I mean, they didn't say how many blacks were fought in the war.
Right.
In the Civil War. They didn't have no mention about the Civil War. I mean, no mention about the blacks in the Civil War. That's what I'm saying. If you do a lot of history, a lot of blacks have fought in the Civil War. Most majority of them was on plantation. And some stayed back, take care of the plantation, and some went out to war.
So did you ever feel like your teachers treated you differently?
You talking about the white teachers?
Well, that was my follow-up question was going to be, you know, after integration, what happened to those black teachers that you had at those all-black schools?
A lot of black teachers that went to a lot of white schools.
So they also integrated?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and one school that I went to attend to, Carver High School in Salem, Virginia. And at the end of the year of 1966, they tried to change that name, Carver High School.
Wow.
Carver High School, they tried to change it. But it was fought, and that name still stands today at George Washington Carver High School.
Wow.
And I got a lot of nieces and nephews that came, they lived in Salem, they came, but they went to the high school, same high school I went to.
So back to the original question, did you feel like your white teachers treated you differently, or you weren't given privileges that the white students were given?
I think it was more towards the white kids more than anything else. We had some teachers, you know, that were open very nicely. We had some that wasn't. Because I don't think they didn't feel comfortable about teaching the blacks.
I agree with that. And education is a big topic, specifically for me, because, you know, when I took my master's classes, you know, I was in it with 24 white girls. Mm-hmm. And a big part of that class was focused on how to teach black children and children of color and how to incorporate history, equity, and equality. And to me, it seemed kind of obvious. Like, I can't believe I'm spending this amount of money to talk about these things, but these things have to be talked about to people who haven't experienced these things, who don't know. Because like you said, I can imagine it could be very uncomfortable for, as a white teacher, to talk about slavery, to talk about, desegregation, the Civil War, to talk about enslaved people. I imagine that can be uncomfortable for them. And then, you know, when you're uncomfortable talking about something, you dance around it and you avoid it.
Right. And then until you're not learning anything either.
Right. You negate a huge part of history when you do that. And that's counterproductive to the education system.
Yeah.
I agree. Wow.
We still got a long ways to go.
Oh, I agree 110%. I do. I agree. And I told, when I was on the Black Educators Matter podcast, I said, it's still a long way to go. I said, I think we're getting better. I think we're recognizing problems that, you know, we've seen for a long time, but we're making the effort to do something about it.
Right. Well, so, back in the time during the segregation, of course, you know, if you look at some of the film that pops up every now and then, how we were treated back then in the South. You know, we were lynched, we were fire hose, using fire hose, we were dogs, attacking the black people. And I think the one reason for that, because during that time, the blacks couldn't vote for their rights. And that's why they were treated, you know, to a negative situation like that.
Oh, yeah. I agree.
But now, I can see a little change.
It's educationally, it's trying to do better. I can say that. Educationally,
Right. Yeah, I can see a little change, but we still, like I said, we still got a long ways to go.
You're right.
But what really disturbed me that we had a lot of these young, they seem they don't understand.
Right.
In fact, first of all, the way I look, to me, like I said, I'm old school, and most of the kids out here today, they don't realize that education is more important than anything in the world, and of course, the doors is open for them to take advantage of it. And a lot of the kids don't.
Right.
A lot of the kids, they sit in school looking pretty, trying to keep up with today's fashion.
Right.
You know, and to go in there and disturb the classroom, still didn't get no books. The world's out there for them.
You are. Right.
We didn't have it, you know, when it's coming up, because we had to fight our way through.
Right.
You know, fire education, and this—I mean—doors wide open for the young kids now. But it all started at home. Right. It all started. If you don't have the respect at home, you won't get it. I don't blame today's education. I don't blame the kids how they act in school. It's come from where they came from.
Okay.
And that's because these kids right now, they're having babies. And they're not, you know, raised up like a household of two parents. But sometimes, why don't take it back? Let me go back. You can find very, very few single parents out here have more focus on the kids than anything else besides having, you know, two people. You know? For example, like single mother who work in two jobs. They're very strong black. Mm-hmm. They want to see their kids, you know, to do right wherever they go. Start at home. You can tell when the kids have if you go in the public, you can tell when the kid is not being don't have no respect for their parents, but due to the fact that the parents didn't have no respect for the kids.
Okay. Interesting. Who is the most influential person in your life and why?
I think my parents. My mom and dad.
Okay. Why so?
Why? Hey, because they brought us up. They took care of us. They made sure that we stayed on in the right lane. They told us about what the value of life is.
Indeed, that's what
that is. When you got some good parents or good people around you influence your life. But my grandparents, same way. I grew up with grandparents and parents. And so when you find those people, they give you a lot of influence because I tell you why, because they are older than I am and they've been around more than I am. And you learn from them. You know, I'm still learning from a lot of people, a lot of elder people. I'm still learning because I haven't got there yet.
And that's what we're doing here. That's the whole point of this.
Right. I haven't got there yet. And you got people out there. So I'm 72 years old. You got people out there that way on that. And I sit down and talk to a lot of senior. I call them seniors. There's a lot of senior. Because they've been through a lot. If you sit down and listen to them, you learn a lot from them.
And that's the point of all of this, because this, I think it's important to learn from those who have experienced things and listen to their voice and value their voice and their opinion.
Right, and a lot of them don't have education, but they got a lot of common sense.
You're right. And common sense is not always so common.
That's right, exactly. Yeah.
But I want to thank you for joining us today. If you would like to reach out to us and give us ideas for the podcast, tell us ways we can improve, make a correction in the research, please feel free to email us at bhshortstories@gmail.com. That's B as in black, H as in history, and shortstoriesplural.com. You may also now follow us on Twitter at bhshortstories. See you guys next week. Thank you, sir.
All right, thank you. I enjoyed it. Thank you. Enjoyed it.